My name is Paul Hurt of Arizona State University, and we're interviewing Cliff Barrett in Salt Lake City. Today is May 15th, 2017, and I'm being assisted by Jen Sweeney and Josh McFadgen, both of Arizona State University. Cliff, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about your experiences. Could you start out by telling us your positions that you've held with the Adaptive Management Program and the Bureau of Reclamation and the years that you've been involved?
With the Bureau of Reclamation, I held a whole string of positions for my whole career, but the ones I could apply to this program probably were when I was Assistant Commissioner for Planning and Operations in Washington, D.C., while the Bureau was studying putting generating units on the outlet tubes. And that study produced some pushback from a lot of environmental groups, the boaters mainly, because they didn't like the fluctuations in flows on the river. And so we decided to stop that study and begin what we call the Glen Canyon Environmental Studies. Glen Canyon, was it Glen Canyon Dam Environmental Studies? I forget the exact name of it, but it was a studies. It was not an EIS, it was an environmental studies thing. And just as I was getting started, I transferred from Washington to become regional director here in Salt Lake City. So that study was going on while I was regional director, and Dave Wagner was in charge of those studies. We had hired him specifically to do those studies. And then in 1989, the studies were still underway, just toward getting toward pretty much being completed. I retired from the Bureau and went to work as executive director of the Colorado River Energy Distributors Association. And that next few years after that, is when legislation was being written, and we cooperated with George Miller in writing the legislation, the Grand Canyon Protection Act. And as a result of that act, then, is when the GCD AMP was put together, and that's how the Adaptive Management Program began, was a result of that act. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that act required the EIS to be done, so that took another several years to get the EIS done. And as part of the doing EIS, CREDA was kind of like a cooperating agency in that whole thing. We attended all the meetings and helped with the drafting of the EIS and all that work. And then in 1993, before that was finished, the ROD wasn't done. The environmental impact study and the record of decision weren't done, I think, until 1995, 96, somewhere along in there. But in 93, I retired from working for CREDA, and since then I worked as a consultant representing CREDA initially on the AMWIC for a short time, and then also on the technical work group. Yeah.
So you've been involved both in AMWIC and TWIG since 1996, right up to this?
Since the beginning, yeah. Yeah. Well, there was 2 years I dropped out. I took a 2-year break and did something else for 2 years and then came back.
Do you still attend any of the AMWIC and TWIG meetings?
Yeah, I do. I do all the TWIG meetings. Well, the thing is, for some health reasons, I in my family, I cannot leave home very often, so I do most of the TWIG meetings by phone. For about the last year, I've done all the TWIG meetings, and the things I've been doing for the program I've been doing by phone and internet and webinar and stuff like that. Yeah.
So the Adaptive Management Program kind of has three parts to it. There's a scientific research mm-hmm. part, there's the policy and management part, and then there's the sort of public engagement, the social and institutional components of it. Which of those three would you say you were most involved in?
Well, the AMWIC deals mainly with policy issues and things like that, mm-hmm. and then the technical work group does
the science.
Mostly the science kind of things. And I've been pretty deeply involved in both of those. So, uh-huh. When you talk about public outreach, you mean?
Well, the stakeholder engagement, the development of the set of relationships between the stakeholders, the evolution of.
They kind of have both within TWIG and AMWIC, I think. Yeah. We all try to work together each other a lot. You go to a TWIG meeting and you sit around a table and there's Indian tribes there, mm-hmm. there's federal agencies there, there's CRETA there, there's four states, and then there's the fishermen group and the Park Service, not the Park Service, but the park recreation people. There's a whole group in, and that whole effort, I think, is aimed at trying to bring these people together and work together on all these issues, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how those relationships have developed or evolved over time in the years that you've been involved?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think, you know, originally there was a lot more contention than you might think. There was a lot of trying to figure out where everybody was coming from, you know, and what were their bottom line, and why were they there to begin with, you know. Over the years, we worked our way through a lot of that, I think. And then with this last, the LTAMP EIS, there was a little bit more conflict there. Anyway, because one of the things they had to do was decide what was the goals of the new long-term management program. Well, everybody had a different set of goals in mind, you know. Uh-huh. And just an illustration, I think, during the development of the Adaptive Management Program, one of the early steps was to develop what we called desired future conditions for each resource. And we had quite a bit of conflict over some of that. And we finally got it all ironed out. And I can tell you, some of the conflict was, when we first started out on that, we tried to form a committee to determine what the future goals for hydropower would be, and we were told there was no future goal for hydropower. Flat out, denied. So we fought that a little bit, and then we finally got hydropower put into the desired future conditions. And then as we went into the LTAMP process, again, they were trying again maybe to ignore that a little bit. So from the hydropower viewpoint, there's been a lot of push and shove, but also a lot of compromise, you know, and in the end we got where we were, what we ought to be.
What do you think is the reason for the success in overcoming initial conflict and getting to a more cooperative result in the end?
Listening to each other. Listening to each other and talking, and you know, review the law, review the legislation. The legislation even says hydropower is a source, a resource, you know. So we had a lot of things like that we had to deal with. But I think mostly it was a matter of overcoming strong feelings of bias. And I think a feeling of thought that hydropower was hurting everything and therefore it shouldn't be a goal at all, you know. And we kind of proved that wasn't true. So.
That seems to be the purpose of these collaborative efforts.
Yeah.
To get different stakeholders with different interests and values together to talk to each other and hammer out compromises. So you feel that effort worked out, it was successful,
it's working,
it was worth
the
effort.
It's working, sure. I think if we hadn't had that, we would have been in, the whole program would have been in shambles, I think.
Without that?
Yeah, we would have spent millions and millions of dollars on lawsuits, I think. And instead, we'd sit down and talk it out, work it out.
That's very hopeful news. So what do you think have been the significant changes that have occurred in the program over the years? It's gone through some evolutionary stages. How do you see that evolution?
Well, I think there are two or three things. I think the scientific knowledge which is being developed has demonstrated that some things aren't as cast in concrete as other people thought they were, you know.
For example?
Well, I think, for example, the hydropower fluctuating flows were completely destructive of beaches, and almost everything was the fault of hydropower fluctuating flows. And we found out now that that's not necessarily true. And we're still learning more and more about that as we go along. We're finding more and more. So as the science is progressing, we're getting answers that says, well, you know, maybe things aren't as black and white as we all thought they were. That's one reason that has changed, I think, is the results of the science is showing that's not necessarily the way it is.
Any other, you said there were three significant changes that you can think of. One is the development of scientific information.
Yeah, that's one. And another big change that took place pretty early on in the program was originally the The Grand Canyon Monitoring and Research Center was a Bureau of Reclamation organization.
Oh, it was?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Well, not many people do, but it's true. It was a Bureau of Reclamation organization. And some of the group thought that that put a huge bias on it. And so they pushed hard to have it taken away from the Bureau and given to the Park Service or somebody.
USGS.
And it ended up being USGS, mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was a pretty big change because mm-hmm. it changed the makeup of the GCMRC and their mission quite a bit, I think.
Do you remember when that was that they made that shift?
I'm trying to remember. No, it was pretty early on in the game. But the first couple of directors of the GCMRC were Bureau of Reclamation employees. Not old-time Bureau of Reclamation, but they were hired by the Bureau of Reclamation to do that job. You know? And then it turned out they formed the GCMRC as a part of the Geologic Survey and made it a branch of the, what's it called, the Southwest. Their headquarters called Southwest Geologic something or other. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so they don't work for Bureau of Reclamation anymore. And I think that made quite a difference.
What difference did it make? In the attitudes of people about
the
science?
The attitudes of people, yeah. It's quite different, I think. Uh-huh. And then the other things I think happened was we're seeing now a lot of, I'm not going to be careful the words I use here. We're seeing a lot more input from Indian tribes than we had in the beginning. They're much more interested in it than they ever were before. And there's a big push for what they call don't use Western science, mm-hmm. use what they call traditional ecological knowledge, I think, which is their view of what happens in the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And there's I've seen in the last 2 years a big push from them. And a lot of support from the department on that. So I think that we're seeing some changes there that we'll see more of later on, I think.
What do you think is resulting or might result from that particular shift?
I'm not quite sure what it's going to do. It's going to be very hard. It's pretty hard for the scientists to deal with. Mm-hmm. And people like me who are longtime engineers, it's a little bit hard for us to deal with. But on the other hand, though, those people have, they've gained a lot of political strength they've not had in the past. You can see that in a number of ways, but
Do you think that'll have any influence on the operation, the annual operation of the river or the dam or the floods?
I don't know if it will or not. I don't know. Well, see, what we've tried to do is to confine the whole program to what we think was what the legislation said. You study the effects of dam operations, and in a rather direct way, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of the tribes are pushing, well, they want to go rim to rim on vegetation and stuff like that. You know, we have a little trouble with that, frankly. We have a lot of trouble with that because, you know, the funding of the program is limited. Mm-hmm. You know, the legislation sets us ceiling on how much money, and it's being all paid for out of power revenues, by the way. Mm-hmm. But it sets a ceiling on that. And if we're trying to get studies done on what is the actual effect of dam operations on the river, and the resources which are directly impacted by the river, we have a little trouble seeing. We're going to go rim to rim on vegetation and things like that. So there's some struggle going on there now.
Can you think of any specific events that occurred over the years that that caused a significant shift in emphasis or policy or relationships or the scientific research being done?
Well, I think one might be the selection of directors for GCMRC. Mm-hmm. You know, Jack Schmidt, who's the one they had before they have now, came in, and he was deeply involved in sediment and sediment transport, and that was his strong suit. And I thought a little shift in the whole program towards that issue and away from some of the other things. And then as he's now left, I think I'm seeing a shift back. Because he was, not that I got anything, Jack Schmidt's a great guy, but it was his focus. His focus was on the, I can remember going to AMWIG meetings and him putting up his chart of the chute of sand going down the river, you know. And he was just very big into that.
So looking back at the various directors of GCMRC, what kinds of emphasis do you see that evolve with the changes of directors? We have the sediment emphasis.
Yeah.
Have there been any others? I assume Humpback Chub.
Well, Humpback Chub is an emphasis because of the Endangered Species Act, not because of who's director of GCMRC.
Okay.
And so there's always been a lot of emphasis on the Humpback Chub. So I don't think that's much of a change.
Okay.
No. No, I don't.
All right. We saw online, as an aside, we saw a website online that had before and after pictures of sandbars along the Colorado River below Glen Canyon. After these
HFEs, yeah.
Yeah, those are really interesting photographs.
They are, yeah. And the HFE experiments are really interesting, and that's been a big push. And
is that recent or
no? I think when we did the first one was back in the. I'm trying to think when we did the first HFE. It was quite a long while back, but it was a huge press event, you know, news and dignitaries here watching it, and I think that may have been part of the charm of it. I think I'm being cynical now. But there was so much fun they did it again and again. You know? But you know, one of the things about the HFEs was that they hoped they would build beaches for campers, for boaters to camp on. They said, "Well, we're building backwaters so humpback chub can use these backwaters as breeding grounds." But it turns out the humpback chub don't use backwaters, but they still kept going because they need the beaches anyway. You know, so you see a lot of that. But then when you really study those photographs, what you find out is that when you do a big HFE, about, I would guess, a little bit less than half the beaches grow. Some get smaller because of the flows, and it really lasts terribly long. Hmm. That's why you have the annual HFE push these days, is to keep the beaches going. Hmm. I think one of the things we're seeing in the whole program is, you know, the law requires you take care of the humpback chub, and those kinds of things. But a lot of the program is aimed towards benefiting recreation and boating, which is a really good thing to do, but I'm getting pretty cynical here. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we do is hiding under the skirt of the Endangered Species Act when it's really doing it for fishermen and boaters. And they're becoming more vocal these days, too, which is good. It's good. Let's get out and talk what we're really talking about here and make it public what we're really talking about here. So I think that's... And they've got some really great people working for them. John Jordan and John Hamill and that crowd, they're smart. John Hamill was at one time GCMRC director.
Oh, really?
Yes. And now he's a loud spokesman for the recreational fishing people. And he really knows what he's talking about, and that's good. And we have a lot of respect for John, and we're getting back where we already talked about what's going on instead of.
You, in your oral history interview that the Bureau of Reclamation did with you, Britt Story did in 1996, there was a significant section in there about the 1982-83 floods during that El Nino period.
Oh yeah.
Do you think that flood had any impact on dam operations, on the developing GCES, the Environmental Studies Program? Was that an event that caused some shifts?
I don't really think so, that much, because it was, that was not the fault of people operating the dam. That was caused by just huge amounts of water had to be passed through the dam, and a design fault in the spillway, which caused a huge problem, which had to be corrected. And it was kind of a heroic effort putting that together and getting the job done and saving the dam. But I think the impacts down the river were
Was that equivalent to a high flow event? I assume
a huge high flow event. Yeah, it was much more than a high flow event. The big change in dam operations, I think, came as a result of the original EIS. You know, when they did the record of decision and set ceilings on how much you could release from the dam, you actually lost about a third of your generating capacity in the dam because you just can't let that. The generators there could, and you wouldn't even let as much water go through as the generators would hold because you had the ceilings on it. And so,
why was that? What was the rationale for?
They want to cut down the fluctuations. So they set a ceiling on how high you could go, a ceiling how low you could go, and then that reduces the amount of fluctuation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, same thing in the rod for the LTIMP study is the same thing. It's a different set of numbers. Actually, a little bit better for us than they were before, but they didn't raise the ceiling. So you're still sitting here with a third of the generating capacity unused.
So the high fluctuations and releases from the dam prior to the EIS were designed to maximize benefits for the hydropower system.
To maximize the value of the power, yeah. Load following, you generate electricity when you need it, mm-hmm. not when you don't need it.
Right.
And when you need it, you need to generate all you can to meet that need. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the EIS then led to a situation in which the dam operators had
stopped load following. Well, they still do load following, but not as much as they did
not
before
as much,
yet. Yeah, they still try to maximize their power. When the record decision for this latest one is fully implemented, we'll have better load following than we had before.
Uh-huh.
But the top and the bottom are still set, you know. And some of that is not. I'll give you an example. The maximum daily change is like, I'm trying to think this now. Make sure I get this right. 8,000 cubic feet per second between these ranges. And that 8,000
over a 24-hour period.
Yeah, that 8,000 second feet daily change comes out of an environmental study which was done clear back in the 90s for the original EIS based on the survey of basically recreationists don't want any more than 8,000 second foot change because it makes the water level go up and down while they're trying to go down the river. And, you know, I took a trip down the river with a bunch of them one time and then they moved their point. That was before we did the EIS. But, you know, they put up their beaches on the boat at night.
And they'd be high and dry in the morning.
In the morning they're high and dry. Yeah, that's the issue, yeah. Uh-huh. So, well, that's... A lot is driven by recreational interests, not...
Just for clarification, you know, can you tell us how much capacity the dam can do? Is it 16,000 or 20,000? I don't know, per second. And what a maximum power, like a big power day, what would you need?
Well, I don't have those figures in my head right off the top.
I have no idea how it works, so...
Yeah, I'm trying to think. It has to do with cubic feet per second, and I'm thinking we could originally gone up to about 35,000 CFS, wow. And we're down now to around 20, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, since you work for CRADA, you're familiar with the larger hydropower system.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the larger power planners adapted to having, you know, Glen Canyon Dam's operations constrained in terms of their fluctuation to meet demand? But how did they make up for that?
The only thing you can do is buy more generation. Because, you know, you build coal fire plant or oil mm-hmm. fire plant, and you build transmission lines to replace it. You know, I don't have the numbers in my head, but there's some really good economic studies done in the LTEMP EIS about what it costs to replace that power. Because you have to go out, float bonds and build another plant. And another thing that I think is changing is as we get down the line a little bit is the impact that all that has on what we're calling now global warming and air quality control. Because, you know, hydropower is a renewable resource which does not produce any air pollution. And it's being replaced by coal or oil, which does. And there's some pretty good studies in the LTAP EIS on that issue. In fact, there's it shows some pretty dramatic numbers, I think, on what the tons of what are they, bicarbonates, whatever it is that they're not supposed to put in the air.
CO2,
yeah, are that result from decreasing generation and replacing it which is the most practical source of replacement. You know, you can't replace hydro with wind, because you have to have something that goes all the time. You have to have a coal-fired plant or an oil plant to replace that.
Base load.
So that's part of the issue, I think.
The coal-fired Navajo generating station was built in the 1970s.
Yes.
And it was built to integrate with the existing hydropower system.
Yeah.
Do you know much about how those were integrated together?
Well, I think the Navajo generating station basically was built to provide pumping power for the Salt River Project in Arizona.
And the Central Arizona
project, yeah. Yeah. Because they get those huge pumping plants down the lower river where they pump the water out and all that. And that's what that was basically
built for.
Yeah, what to do that with. Yeah.
Now that's just a minority of the power.
Yeah.
Although Navajo Generating Station is slated to close down.
It's going to shut down in a year. Yeah, it's going to shut down in a year. I don't know what they'll do to replace it. But I think, you know, with the emphasis that's coming these days on global warming and climate control, things like that, we'll find more and more thought being given to regarding hydropower as a renewable resource that ought to be protected instead of...
You think decisions related to management of the river are going to begin to reprioritize clean energy, hydropower generation as clean energy for...
Well, one has that hope. I don't know if it'll work or not, but I think, you know, this administration, I think, is probably more open to that than the last group was. We're kind of waiting to see who fills in all the slots in Department of Interior to see about that.
It's taking some time.
Taking some time, yeah, yeah.
Another question for you. Can you mention or alert us to any key reports or documents that you think were particularly important to the development of the Adaptive Management Plan? You've mentioned the EIS. Is there anything else that we should be aware of that you think was significant in the development of the program?
I can't bring up any in my mind right away, no.
All right. And how about key individuals? You mentioned the gentleman who was head of GCMRC as being significant in shaping the direction of some of the research.
Yeah.
Any other key individuals that really made a difference in the program?
That was David Wagner, right?
GCMRC director was...
Jack Schmidt, yeah.
Yeah, Dave Wagner was...
He was head of the Grand Canyon Environmental Studies.
Which GCES program.
The Bureau did those, yeah. Yeah, he was with the Bureau then, and he left and went to work for some congressional staffers, I think, and then I don't know where he is now. He's in Tucson, yeah.
Yeah, he's in Tucson. We're going to interview him sometime this year. Yeah.
Any other big reports that you have to look at? I can't really off the top of my head. There's some interesting work that the AMWAG did, which kind of influenced the program. And I don't know if they rewrote reports on that, but there was the whole study on desired future conditions. Mm-hmm. That might be worth looking at.
When was that?
I'm thinking that was in the early stages of the Adaptive Management Program. It was after I left, went to work as a consultant instead of directing. It was done after that. So I would say 98, 99, somewhere along in there. I don't know. But they did do a paper on that, and there's a desired future conditions report which is fed into the study.
Was there only one of those?
I think there was only one. There was a lot of drafts of it, but the final one, which was adopted, yeah.
It would be interesting.
I think it was adopted by the AMWAG by a vote. It was a desired future conditions thing.
Great.
Can't think of any other right off the top of my head. There's been an interesting economic studies done.
Yeah.
You know, we thought that in the LTAM process that, that power was being pretty much undervalued in the economic studies. And so Western Area Power Administration found out that the University of Oklahoma and some other people were doing a study on environmental and economic impacts of the hydropower. And that study is certainly worth looking at, I think. It paints quite a different picture than what the LTAM did. And then there's, I'm trying to think if there's anything else on the... Well, not right off the top of my head, I can't think of any. And some other documents that might be useful to look at would be, you know, when they did the when they did the record of decision, they had to do a biological assessment and then a biological opinion on
the endangered species.
On the endangered species, but those are kind of worth looking at too because they put a little different spin on things. Yeah.
Looking back at all the years that you've been involved, you said that you were kind of a representative of CRADA and the hydropower interests. What do you think you were able to accomplish in those years as a representative of that interest?
Well, I think CRADA, and I'm not trying to pat myself on the back here, because I think CRADA had a lot of input into the George Miller's work on the Grand Canyon Protection Act. We had quite a bit of input into that, which was, from our viewpoint, pretty successful. And then George Miller, after it was all over, he and I shook hands and said, we did a good job here, you know.
What kind of influence or impact on the legislation itself did you work on?
We talked about funding of the program. That's how it came to be funded out of power revenues. We talked about the need for, you know, the adaptive management involving stakeholders in the whole program. That was part of the effort we had there. So I think it was a beneficial relationship there, yeah.
Do you think we should try to interview George Miller at some point? Do you think he would have valuable perspective on this?
He certainly has a very powerful perspective on it, yeah. Yeah, it was his push for the legislation, yeah. He might give you some different viewpoints than I'm giving you on it, but yeah.
And he was the key sponsor, and
the negotiation
over what would go into the bill was, yeah, you know, between him and his staff and what, everybody in Amwig or key people?
Well, it was not an Amwig then, because the adaptive management program didn't exist until after the legislation. Yeah, that was part of the good things of legislation. We got put into that as an adaptive management program, so it didn't get locked down tight forever in one piece of legislation, you know. So that was a good piece of work. But basically involved in drafting legislation was the Bureau, represented a lot by David Wagner and us, and then the Western Area Power Administration was involved in it some. But there were, I think Park Service was deeply involved also.
Was there anything that you hoped to accomplish that you weren't able to, and why?
Well, that's some unrealistic hopes, yeah. I think it came out as about as good as I thought we could get it, yeah.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but I want to ask you again, what do you think has been the value of the program over time?
The value of the Amwig program?
Yeah.
I think it has produced a lot of understanding and cooperation between people who have completely different views of what ought to be happening below the dam, why the dam is the way it is. You involve four states. I think you involve all seven states are involved in the Amway program, you know, because the way the Colorado River is operated is basically driven by the Colorado River Compact, which is a compact between the basin states. And that says that decides how much water you can run down in a year. You know, those kind of the Colorado River Compact and the later interim operating agreements and all those things, they have a big impact on what happens here. And I think the AMA would help bring all those kind of people together a little bit more. They build a little bridge between the upper basin and the lower basin on some of these issues. And I think it also built some bridges between reclamation and the Park Service, who at one time I think were not very much speaking to each other. Well, they did, but they weren't listening to each other. That's a better way of putting it. And then bringing in the fishermen groups and the boating groups, because they all have a deep interest, which a lot of people don't understand, and that gives them a forum to lay out their issues and their problems. And then you have, again, the Indian tribes, who I think are listened to so much more now than they were before. And so I think the program has produced a lot of good in bringing people together, and it's working. It's working. I would really hate to see the FACA thing kill the Amway program. I don't think it will, but because I think cooler heads will prevail, you know.
FACA being the Federal Advisory
Committee Act, the Trump thing, you know, about we're going to stop all the FACA activities until September, which is really a problem because we were right in the middle of putting together a budget for GCMRC and the Bureau for the next 3 years. And we would like to at least get the next year done. But, you know, their fiscal year starts in October, doesn't it? Mm. October 1 is the beginning of the fiscal year. And if they don't come up with something, they're in deep trouble. And
so this order from the Trump administration to suspend the activities of AMWIC for a while, that is going to stop the budgeting process?
I don't think so, because they'll have to go ahead without us. Uh-huh. They'll have to go ahead without us. But I think, based on some conversations we've had, I think they're still going to talk to us about it. We won't have a formal meeting or formal webinars, but I think they almost have to talk to us. Because I tell you what, GCMRC and the Bureau came in with their first draft budgets. They were 30% over ceiling for the first year. For the fiscal year 18, they're 30% over ceiling. So they've got to reduce their budgets by 30%. And how do they pick which ones to keep, which ones to let go? If they don't ask the stakeholders, they're going to be in real trouble, I think. And I think they will. I think they will ask us about that. In fact, we see some indications that they'll be willing to talk to us about it. But they have to move forward. They can't just stop the program.
Right.
As much as some parts would like it to.
Some might want that.
Some budget concerns might say, well, this is, you know, I think a lot of the FACA stuff, they were thinking this is wasted money, you know. Mm-hmm. But in this instance, it is not wasted money. This is, in fact, most of the AMWIC people fund their own participation. You know, we don't get paid to do that by the federal government. We get paid by the power users for me to go to it. Uh-huh. And the boaters pay for their guy to go to it. And the fish guys pay for their guys to go to it. So it's not costing the government a whole lot of money except some federal employees who are involved in it. But their total budget is pretty high. But I think people just don't realize that's the Adaptive Management Program, not the Federal Advisory Committee Program.
Right. You know? Yeah. That's all the research and monitoring taking place.
Yeah, which has to take place. You have to have research and monitoring.
Yeah. You can't learn.
No, you can't. That's right.
Otherwise, yeah.
Yeah.
If there are any, you have a fairly positive view of the program and its accomplishments. Are there any key limitations that you'd like to see, overcome? Is there anything, any changes that you'd like to see in the program in the future that would make it work even better?
Not right off the top of my head. It's working. Given what you have to work with, and what the challenges are, I think it's working pretty well.
So you're hopeful about the future of the program?
Oh yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah.
How about the future of Bureau of Reclamation and the future of management of the Colorado River? Step back a little bit. Any Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the larger picture about Colorado River management in the seven basin states?
I try to be optimistic, but I think, you know, as we come down, and this is not a Glen Canyon Dam issue, this is more a Colorado River operations issue. As you come down, if the drought continues and, you know, it turns out to be a long-term permanent shift in how much water we're going to have, I think there's going to be some real issues on the Colorado River. And I think the states are going to have to work that out. States and Mexico are involved in all that. And that could be a real challenge. It could be a real challenge because there's, you know, the upper basin is not using all their water, but they save it, Glen Canyon Dam, in case they want to use it. In the lower basin states, they're using every drop of their water and running short. So you may someday see some shifts in, I really hate to think that happens, but I think one solution would be to renegotiate the Colorado Basin Compact. You know, I don't know if that'll ever happen or not, but there's a lot of things there. And then also the use of power revenues to support these studies is very deeply impacting the upper basin states, because they get under the Colorado River Basin Project Act, they have projects which are authorized or could be authorized which are entitled to a share of the basin revenues. Hmm. Well, the basin revenues go down because there's no power generation and there's no money for them to share. And that could be one huge issue someday. I don't see it happening anytime soon, but if you look way down the line, there could be some real problems, yeah.
Any lessons in the success of AMWIG? Are there any lessons in there that could be applied to the states negotiating over shortages on the Colorado River?
Well, I think it's a different kind of program altogether, I think. The states have done a pretty good job of negotiating out their compacts and things like that. And you go back to the days when they were negotiating out the compact, and in the 1940s, I think it was when they did all that. And they work together very, very well, and I think they can still do that. They just have to recognize that
we're all in this together.
Somebody has to win, somebody has to lose, you know. But as the United States together, we're winners, you know. So, I mean, I'm saying, you know. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Do you have any advice for new members who would be joining AMWIG or TWIG? One of the things we're going to produce is an orientation packet for new members so they can come up to speed on on the program and progress. Do you have any key pieces of advice you would give to somebody joining the program?
I would suggest they listen carefully and be patient with each other, because I see it, you know, the people I work for, there's a lot. There's some impatience with other people in the AMWIG, and I'm one of them. You're like, wait, you know, where are these guys coming, where they're coming from on this? And I think we just need to have a little bit more understanding and a little bit more patience. And again, I think one of the real challenges we're going to have in the not too distant future is accommodating the Indian tribes and their whole different approach to this whole thing. And I think we just really have to sit down and listen and not be so quick to judge. And maybe we can work this out. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
Can you expand on that? And you mentioned traditional ecological knowledge earlier. And can you expand on maybe some ways that those two different ways of thinking about science can be and the natural world?
Well, yeah, because I'll give you an example that kind of jumps out about every third meeting we have is, you know, one of the things that the brown trout, which is not a native species, and the rainbow trout, which is definitely not a native species, are killing, in some situations, they go downstream and eat the baby humpback chub. So the immediate reaction from a Western science perspective is, well, let's just get rid of the rainbow trout, brown trout, and control them, and when there's too many of them, we'll electrofish them and take them out of the river, and they won't go down and eat the humpback chub. Which makes a lot of logical sense from a Western science viewpoint. But the Indian tribes say, wait, you're taking life in the Grand Canyon. And the Grand Canyon to them was a very holy and spiritual place. And you don't go down there and kill things. Now, what do you do? Yeah, but something has to be done, because you can't just ignore them.
Interesting conundrum.
It is. It's tough. And you find those kind of things, and they say, well, the archaeological sites, you know. They'll say, the archaeology sites are being destroyed. Well, we say, who's destroying them? Well, the campers come in and walk around and kick the stones over, you know. Now, that's a stretch. You know, but people going to look at the archaeological sites hurt the archaeological sites. Like, we say, well, why is that an effect of dam operations? Well, but we have to take care of it anyway, because it's within the, you know. So there's all kinds of things there that need to really be worked out. And I would suggest that in the next few years, we need to have a lot more patience and understanding and trying to understand that. Because they're, like I said, the Zuni and some other tribes are just really coming out of their boxes and talking about this and wanting to do stuff about it. And the department and the Bureau of Reclamation are trying to accommodate them as much as they can. And so you just have to go along with that and help with that situation.
That reminds me of the shift that occurred in the 1970s and 80s in terms of managing the Colorado River. In your oral history interview with Britt Story in 1996, you mentioned that prior to the 1970s, at least, it was kind of a family affair, and people with the Bureau of Reclamation would talk to representatives from the states, and decisions would be made pretty quickly and efficiently about how to manage the river to meet the needs of the states, et cetera. Yeah. And you mentioned that sometime in the 70s and early 80s that there was more and more pressure from environmentalists to insert themselves and broader publics into the process. And I think you even mentioned that you had kind of misjudged that change as it was coming along. And can you talk a little bit about that important shift and how it happened?
I think I think as over time we developed water projects to develop an economy and a society which was developing, and they wanted the water really bad because they need to have their farms, they need to have their factories, they need to have their electricity and all that. And then as a society, we got all these things, we get more comfortable, then we now have time to say, oh, but you know, maybe we need to worry about the humpback chub now, and maybe we need to worry about these other things now. And I just really never really fully grasped in those earlier years the impact that would have on the program, how strong those feelings would be. But I think it's because, when you solve a problem, then people don't have to worry about that problem, and they can worry about the next one. Mm-hmm. And they're not so worried about the water anymore because they've got all the water they need, and they've got all the electricity they need, and they've got food, and they've got money. So now we can worry about these other things. But when you start worrying about those things, the things that are making it possible are also hurting these other things, and you need to go back and rethink some of those things. And I think our, as a society, our whole society is much more oriented towards environmentalism and protecting these things. And I'm not saying that's bad, but that's just the way it is. They're much more oriented toward it now than they were before. And we have to learn to deal with that.
It sounds a little bit like the same thing is happening now with the growing influence of the tribes, that it wasn't a central part of the decision-making process before, and now it is, and there's this adjustment period.
And we can afford to do it now that we couldn't do it before. Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
Is there anything else that you think we're not paying attention to yet that we're going to have to start paying attention to?
Not right off the top of my head. No, we got too much to pay attention to now. Yeah. No, I think
it's gotten pretty complicated.
It has gotten very complicated. Yeah.
Well, talk about that a little bit. How has decision, in your mind, you know, there's pros and cons to every change.
Yes.
Some people win, some people lose. We have more participation, more voices, more values represented. What's the downside to that? Is it all good, or have we lost something in the process of that?
Well, yeah, you talk about the decision-making process. I think what I'm seeing happening is decisions that used to be made at the Bureau level and the Park Service level, and GLAC Service level, are now raised up. They're being made at the Assistant Secretary level or the Secretary's designee level. Mm-hmm. You know, like AMWIG submits its suggestions to the Secretary of Interior, mm-hmm. not to the Commissioner of Reclamation or the Director of Park Service.
So you've seen a centralization.
It's a centralization. It's a centralization of power. Yeah.
Is that good or bad? What are the pros and cons of that?
It slows things down quite a bit, I think.
Because you have to wait for.
You have to wait for answers, and then you have.
Does it politicize it more?
Yes. Absolutely.
Can you think of any instances in which the local people, like AMWIG, or a group of decision makers, you know, worked something out and then sent it on up for approval and it got either stalled or stymied?
Yes. I'll tell you an example is desired future conditions for the Colorado River, which are all pounded up by AMWIG, they all agreed to it. And then over time, it's being challenged from the top down. Hmm.
Any other examples that you can think of?
Not right off the top of my head, no.
When you were in Washington, you spent a lot of time focused on policy and budgets, and that's something we haven't talked about much yet today.
Mm-hmm.
But in your 1996 oral history, you talked about how important the budgeting process is for determining what gets done.
Well, yeah, and that's true. In those days, I was with the Bureau of Reclamation's budget, you know, mm-hmm. that's what I was working on. And we couldn't do anything if it wasn't budgeted. You know, you had to get your budget and get your appropriate funds from Congress and move forward. And the Deputy Manager Program is a little bit different animal because it gets its budget was set by law. It said you'll use power revenues and here's the ceiling and it indexes each year according to the CPI and all that. So they know how much money they got to spend. Now, some of the agencies, like I know the Bureau of Reclamation, the Park Service, both are using other sources of money to do things they want to do, which they feed into the AMWIG program, and that works good. But budgeting is a big issue. It's a huge issue.
So even though the AMWIG budget is set statutorily,
yeah.
and it's reliably there, I imagine there must have been some debates and controversies over how to allocate that funding, what kind of research.
We have that every year. We have that every year, yeah. It's like I said, they come out the budget that's 30% over the budget or the ceiling, then you have to decide, well, what things are we not going to do? And the technical working group, the TWIG group, has a budget ad hoc group called the BAG group, which I'm a member of.
The TWIG bag.
The TWIG bag. I'm a member of the TWIG bag. And we were working very hard on trying to get the budget put together for the next 3 years,
uh-huh.
especially the next year. And in fact, we were kind of pushing, the CRETA side was pushing, let's do a one-year budget and not settle on a three-year budget until we get some more people on board from the administration. Because, you know, some of the thinking was you'd set a three-year budget, then you wouldn't change it for 3 years. If you, year one, year two, year three were locked down, which takes away the learning experience, what happened year one should change year two, should change year three. We kind of had a little trouble wrestling about that. But the whole process, it has to be worked out. And budgeting is very important because it does control what research we're going to do. We have research that directly applies to the Grand Canyon program. And then, but I think the same researchers are also finding really interesting studies they'd love to do, and interesting and scientifically valid and important, but really don't impact Grand Canyon Dam operations.
Hmm.
And so, but we find some money in their budget to do that. And then we say, well, no, you shouldn't be doing this. But
Have there been any significant debates over funding since you've been involved that you can recall, or significant issues that had to be resolved over how funding decisions would be made?
No, I think, well, what happens, the way the process is that the technical working group recommends a budget to the AMWIG, and the AMWIG recommends a budget to the secretary. So there's that process here. So how we decide what we're going to recommend to the secretary is what it comes down to. And you try not to, right? Well, you shouldn't recommend to the secretary anything that's over budget, you know, because he hasn't got any money to do that with. So it's then how do we decide what's more important to put in the budget than other things? And there's some debate about that, certainly, yeah.
How long has it been since the Secretary of Interior had to approve the budget? Was there ever a time in which the budget was managed autonomously?
Not for this program, no.
No.
Well, I think not for anybody. Actually, no matter what agency you work for, the process is you draft your budget, the secretary recommends it, OMB, OMB decides, and it comes back down to feedback, you know, and so there's always layers of oversight, but.
Could the administration sweep those funds or say that you can't spend them? Or is that authority not there because of the law?
I'm not sure. I think the law says the law sets up the program and authorizes money to spend on it, so I'm not sure they could. Yeah. I suppose they could say we're not going to spend the money you authorized for us. We're going to put it in the bank and save it or do something with it, but I don't see that happening. I just don't see that ever happening.
Do you think the change in administrations in Washington, D.C. at any point since you've been involved have a significant spillover effect on the local level of management? Or are you kind of, is AMWIG sort of insulated from, you know, presidential changes?
Well, I don't think they're insulated from it.
No,
I don't. No, because, you know, a change in the secretary, the change in the deputy secretary, directly impacts the program because the person in charge of the AMWIG program is the secretary's designee. He's appointed by the secretary.
Can we go back and look at those presidential changes and have you, I mean, when Obama came in and new people were appointed to Interior, what kind of changes do you remember seeing as a result?
Well, I think we'll find a lot more environmentally sympathetic administration than we'd had under the Bush administration. Yeah.
And what would that mean? What's
well, it means you when you put together your program, you say, well, we're going to concentrate more on humpback chub than we are on power, uh-huh. Something like that, you know.
And so under the Bush administration, you feel that there was a little more emphasis on power?
No, I'm saying they weren't quite as strict. That's what I'm saying. They weren't quite as hardliners.
Uh-huh.
They weren't maybe quite as vocal.
Uh-huh.
But I think in the Obama administration, we had some people who were pretty hardliners.
Yeah. How about the Clinton administration? What was the character of that influence?
I don't really remember that far back.
No.
The truth. Yeah.
So I won't go back to the first Bush then?
No, don't go back to the first Bush or Carter or any of those people, no.
All right. The whole concept of adaptive management that the AMWIG is based on, mm-hmm. was kind of an artifact of the 1990s, late 80s and early 90s was a time in which scholars and resource managers sort of floated this idea of flexible, adaptive management. Do you remember when that first came in as a management paradigm, and what did you think of it, and how easy was it to embrace it?
The first time I'd ever really thought about it or got involved in it was with this program. And I remember...
Did it seem to make sense to you at the time, or did it feel a fad?
No, it makes sense to me, and it still does make sense to me. It's a lot better than just drawing a line, and here's what we're going to do no matter what. Okay, we'll experiment with this and see how it works, and if it doesn't work, we'll change it. We'll try to get what works best. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
You adapt your management to reach the goal you want to set. And that's the tricky part of setting the right goals.
What was the nature of decision making prior to this embrace of adaptive management?
like you just decide what you're going to do, and that's it. And I don't think we were planning on experimenting and letting people from the outside come in and say, well, you should try this. And the stakeholder involvement wasn't that great. And the flexibility wasn't there.
Do you think NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969, had a significant impact on public involvement and environmental analysis? Or was it not until GCES came in that really anything began to change in how the Colorado River and Glen Canyon Dam were operating?
When you talked about Colorado River and Glen Canyon Dam, it was probably GCES is what did it, yeah.
That's what did it.
Yeah, I think so. I can remember as regional director, we did the GCES, and then we actually modified some of our operating criteria for the dam to do what we thought helped. And I remember meeting in my office hall here where a group of environmentalists came and said, why don't you do an EIS? And I said, why don't we do an EIS? And they said, so you could change your operations? We did change the operations. You know, so I didn't see much need for doing it, because the EIS is a long, complicated, expensive process. I thought we'd made the changes necessary, but they were pushing very hard for an EIS because it gives them a forum. You know, when you do an EIS, it's published in the Federal Register, and everybody has the chance to talk about it. And so it really opened up the forum for them, and they pushed for it. I think if I'd been on their side, I would have done the same thing.
How did the GCES program get started?
Like I said, we were looking at the results of the study we did to put power plants on the outlet tubes, and the environmental impacts of those were causing some concern, and so we decided we will do an environmental study on the impacts of Glen Canyon Dam. That was a Bureau decision.
That was not pushed by a statute. That was a Bureau decision.
That was a Bureau decision.
I think I remember hearing something about James Watt was a little bit involved in authorizing that, or...
Yeah, I think that's true.
And he was interested in that because environmentalists were putting a lot of heat on the Interior Department and Bureau of Reclamation
at
the time.
Yeah.
So this was accommodating an interest group that was becoming more powerful at that time.
Yeah.
And how did that evolve? Environmentalists were pushing for an EIS. You guys were saying we could do the same thing without all the complications.
And so they went to George Miller and got the Grand Canyon Protection Act authorized, which requires an EIS.
That was 1992.
Yeah.
So the GCES started around 1982?
82 or 83, somewhere along there, yeah. Very early on, yeah.
How did it develop to the point where an act of Congress finally intervened?
Well, I think the environmentalists were pushing that because we thought we'd made the changes we needed to make. And they wanted more changes. I think that was what it was. So they went to George Miller and got them. That's how it happened, I think.
Well, do you guys have any additional questions you'd like to ask? I've gone through my list and added some to it.
Well, I mean, how do you feel? It's been over an hour. Do you want to?
I'm all right.
We can continue. Do you, Jen? I think we covered a lot of the big sort of structural issues and what these different agencies do. And what's you're still involved, really involved, which is pretty neat. And I guess maybe what do you see as a role for consultants, people like yourself now? Are you just one more voice from one agency? Well, you've got a lot of history with this, and
I think
we're writing a history. We'll have a different input, but you've got a lot of experience to share.
I think the role of the consultant is to represent his people at the table, you know.
Yeah.
And I believe in doing that. And, actually, at the technical working group, I'm not a representative of CREDA. I'm a representative of Utah Associated Municipal Power Systems, which is a CREDA member. And that's how power gets its two people at the table. You know,
one from CREDA. Second person?
Leslie. The actual appointed guy is Bill Davis, who's a consultant to CREDA also. He's a fish and wildlife biologist. He's a fish biologist, really. So we have a mixture of two kind of skills at the table there. But we basically take our direction from Krita and Leslie James. You've met Leslie James, I think, haven't you? She's the executive director of Krita. She's the AMWIG member from Krita. Yeah. Leslie James is the AMWIG member from Krita. Ted Rampton is the AMWIG member from UAMPS. And at the TWIG, I represent Ted, and Bill Davis represents Leslie James. That's how it works. And so we all sing off the same chart, though. There's no... We talk to each other.
Do you plan to keep doing it?
Well, you know, a guy has to have something to do. And I had my 84th birthday in February.
Wow. Congratulations. So,
but
my mom just turned 84 in April.
And I don't know how much longer I'll do this, but... I have deep interest in it, and it's exciting and fun, and like I say, guy has something to do. You know, my neighbor cuts his lawn three times a week, and I just go out and I come to meetings. It's different, but I like it better.
Is there anybody else like Leslie James or others who are more knowledgeable about the power side of this, you know, AMWIG that we should interview?
I think Leslie James is probably the power person you need to enter to.
Has she been involved for a long time?
She, from the beginning, yeah, she took my place. When I left Krita, she took my place. So. Hmm. Well, there was one other guy in between there for about a year and a half, but she's basically been the driver of Krita for quite a long while.
So we should try to interview her.
Interview her, yeah.
Where does she live?
She lives in Phoenix.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's convenient.
Perfect. Is that where Krita's based?
That's what the office is, yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the office was here until I left, and then they hired Leslie James, and they moved the office to Phoenix. That's where she lived. So she has deep history in power. She was a Salt River Project person for a number of years. Yeah.
Anybody else who's been around a long time that would have an interesting perspective that we should interview?
There's a fellow from the state of Colorado that I would suggest you interview. It's going to take a minute to come.
Dave Garrett.
No. Dave Garrett, he was one of the science advisors. I'm talking about the representative on TWIG from Colorado. Oh, I can't think of his name. That's my fault. I can't think of people's names anymore.
I can look that up. A TWIG rep from Colorado?
Yeah, TWIG.
Been around a long time.
Been around a long time, yeah. Randy Seaholm. You heard that name.
How do you spell his last name?
You're nodding. She's heard that name already.
Yeah. How do you spell his last name?
Seaholm. I think Seaholm is like you sounded. Yeah. Yeah. He's been around a long time.
All right. If there are no more, do you have any stories you'd like to tell us? Like, for example, we're all really interested in... the drama of 1982-83 when you had to put the plywood up so you could raise the dam some more.
Yes. And that was scary. That was the scariest time of my life.
You want? Yeah, well, tell us that story. We'd like to
There's a couple of videos out on that you can get, you know.
Okay.
But it was I don't think it was a design mistake, which is everybody thought about it, I guess, but as the water goes over to spill away, it creates little bubbles, and then the bubbles explode and they pop the concrete and chip out the concrete. And when you have a huge flow like we had there, and for so long a time, it caused big cavities in the concrete spillway. And you know, you started seeing red water come out the end, which meant there was a lot of sandstone in the water. And it was a scary time. It was really scary.
How long did that last? Days or weeks?
Weeks. Mm-hmm. And then we put the plywood up so we could close the spillway gates and shut them off. And we went down there and I actually took one of those little trips down there and had a little cart on a cable to see what was going on down there. And we had some magnificent design people in Denver who figured out what was going on. They figured out how to fix it, and we got an emergency contractor in there and got the whole darn thing fixed and before the next flood started. So it was an amazing piece of work. It really was. And I don't take much credit for that because I didn't do any of the all I did was sit at the top and say, yeah, go do this. You know, it was not my work. It was somebody else's work. It was a scary time.
You did a little bit of, if I remember correctly, some design work, stress test design work in your very early career. In
my first job with the Bureau was on designs of Glen Canyon Dam. Uh-huh. Yeah, the design of the dam, the arch structure itself, which at that point in time, the first one ever built was Hoover Dam, a thin arch dam, and we've thinned them down a lot since then. Uh-huh. But it was still a very interesting thing. It was kind of, that wasn't any of the brains behind it. In those days, we used Marshall calculators instead of computers, you know. And we were computing the stresses in the dam as it was being designed. And one of the most famous dam designers in the world, a fellow named Merlin Copen, worked for the Bureau then, and he was in charge of designing the dam itself. And I worked for him, directly for him, and I just happened to luck into that job. Actually, you can turn this thing off. I was hired to work in earth dams.
Should I?
No, it's all right.
Okay.
This is not part of the interview. I was hired by the Bureau to work in the earth dam section because I was really interested in earth mechanics because I'd studied that when I was in the Army, the Corps of Engineers. And I interviewed the guy who was head of the earth department, and he hired me. But when I reported for work, they said, well, we've changed our mind. We're going to put you in the concrete dam section. Why? Well, because that's where we have a vacancy for you. So I went to work. It was probably the best thing that ever happened. Because I got to meet with this man, Erwin Copeland, and he was really something else. Just a whiz. He knew what he was doing. And we had dam designers from all over the world come to Denver to visit with Merlin Copeland. Hmm. And he would invite me in to sit in the meetings with him. He liked me for some reason. And I did that for about a year. Then I moved on to something else. But
you mentioned earlier in the interview that there was a design flaw in the outflow.
I don't say it's a design flaw. It's just they didn't know, you know. So it was they then since then they've created a design which avoids that.
Right.
When we rebuilt it, we built it to a new design. I say flaw, that means like sort of made a mistake, and that isn't really true. They just did the best they could with what they knew, the knowledge they had at the time. That's what they did.
It's like adaptive management. You do the best you can, yeah. And then you go to work, and yeah. Then you
and once they found
monitor,
there was a problem,
and then adapt.
They were in the process of modifying dams to create, they had that kind of spillway were being modified. Flaming Gorge has been modified, Glen Canyon has been modified, several others have all been modified to do that new design to avoid that problem.
It's interesting, if you had stayed in earthen dams, you would have been at the center of the storm when Teton Dam blew out.
Well, I kind of was anyway. Because where I was in Washington at the time. Uh-huh. Yeah, Teton Dam blew out. Yeah, that's true.
What kind of impact did that have on the Bureau?
Quite a bit. That was a real shocker for everybody in the Bureau. Like one of our dams failed. You know, that's you don't like that.
No.
And it had quite an impact.
Did you change design?
Oh, yes. The whole design of earth dams has changed since then. And they've gone back and modified almost all the major earth dams have been modified to solve that problem. Uh-huh. There's another problem nobody... Yeah, is this still going?
Yes. It is. Would you like me to turn it off?
Yeah, shut it off.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.